Papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis where you have some veteran editors giving you insight into newsroom decision-making and talking about some of the ethical quandaries that often confront journalists at all levels. I'm Rex Smith, formerly editor of the Times Union, now publishing the Upstate American on Substack. And I'm here with two colleagues, Judy Patrick, the former editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady, Barbara Lombardo, formerly executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record of Troy. How are we today?
Speaking for myself, terrific. Judy looks terrific.
Yeah, I am grateful because for many years I wished I was part of the White House press corps that would fly aboard Air Force One. And this week, I'm glad I never got on board.
You could have gotten a seat. There was an open seat, I heard.
There was room. All of a sudden, people are flocking away from it. You've heard a lot about this, folks, already, but we do want to at least give you a little insight into some thoughts here about this great story of the NATO summit in Turkey in early July when it came time for President Trump to begin his trip home, and he chose not to take the plane that was gifted to him by Qatar. It was supposed to be the new Air Force One. He said he'll take the old Air Force One because it turned out that it was because of an assassination threat, according to the Washington Post's original reporting. Then it turns out he wasn't on that flight either. He boarded the plane and immediately went into a kitchen service vehicle, which took him to another flight. And nobody knew until, again, the Washington Post belatedly reported this a couple of weeks later, that he was secretly shuttled onto a smaller plane, an Air Force C-32A, via the catering truck. And so, what issues do we have here? We've got the press being unaware, the public being unaware that of a deception. We've got the decoy plane, journalists in effect, being on Air Force One where the president wasn't. What do we think about all this? Anybody have opinions?
Yeah. So many levels on this, but the ultimate story here is the lack of trust we have with the administration about what they tell us and what we can rely on as the truth. As we sit here now, we still have an unanswered question. Was there a serious threat? We don't know. Are the planes used to transport the president safe? We don't know. Can we count on the administration to tell us when our lives are in danger as journalists? We don't know. And I think there's a certain level of knowledge that we as journalists and we as the American public have a right to that we did not get in this case. A lot of twists and turns. This story, if only they had been more forthright, it would have been a 1 or 2 day story. But now we're like in the second week of coverage, and I don't know what other twist or turn it's going to take, but I still have unanswered questions.
There would be if there was a camera in that cafeteria cart that carried him. We might have more to talk about. But remember that the initial story was because the Qatari gift plane was not adequately equipped to protect the president or anybody else on the plane in the event of an attack. And that was the first lie that was told, not just to the media, but to the public, that this plane's going to be great. I can take this. There's no problem. It's all set. And then it was leaks that the media was able to reveal that was not a safe plane. And that's why they had to switch to another plane.
And let's not forget, the reporters were subpoenaed in that case.
And so that is big news. And then the subpoenas were withdrawn because they were ridiculous to begin with.
Or was it because they didn't want to have discovery in the case, which would have revealed this deception before the Washington Post managed by reporting to reveal it anyway? But it does raise the question that Judy rightly makes, that it all goes back to a question of credibility. There is so much that we are being lied to over and over again, consistently, constantly, by the Trump administration, that there is no reason to have any sense of trust that when you're told that the president is somewhere, that he in fact is, or when you're told why he's not somewhere, that's why.
But when somebody's safety is at stake, so if the president's safety is at stake, I totally get it that you're not going to announce to the world through the media, you're certainly not going to leak to the media, you hope, that, hey, by the way, he's not on this plane.
And there have been many circumstances where reporters have been taken on secret missions, where they have gone with the president into enemy territory secretly, where the press corps traveled with the president. It is not that journalists don't maintain confidences. They do. What is in doubt here is credibility. It is all about an issue of credibility, which raises the question, speaking of which, if you were to refer to the architects of the half-truths of the White House, of course, the boss is in charge of this.
That's generous, by the way.
The half-truths, yes. I suppose that's a euphemism. But it is a big deal to report out that the White House press secretary is leaving. Caroline Leavitt has decided that she is quitting as the very visible front face. She just had a second child, and so she's going to be leaving the White House podium.
And says she wants to spend time with her family, not just because she had a second child. I just want to clarify that he has said it.
The problem is, of course, that line becomes what everybody says when they leave a public job, right? To spend more time with the family. Notwithstanding that, because my immediate assumption was when I saw the headline, Caroline Leavitt stepping down, oh, she's the source. They've identified her as a source for some of the leaks.
You are so cynical.
Remember, Toby got pushed out of the White House in the Barrett administration. Sorry, folks.
I haven't reached that far in the series.
Oh,
my rerun of the damn. So let's not forget that Caroline Leavitt is the architect responsible for remaking the White House press corps briefing room, bringing in these stray semi-journalists from the far right to ask silly questions like, how does the president maintain his youthful good looks, or those kinds of questions.
Semi-journalists, yes. Also.
She spoke Trump fluently. She worked with him on his campaign, but then she came in. She was like a female version of Donald Trump, but even more on target than he often is. She abused the press. I mean, I think abuse is a good word. She abused the reporters in the room.
I think that's fair. Let's listen to just a little bit to give just a flavor of Caroline Leavitt.
It's an honor to be here with all of you. A lot of familiar faces in the room, a lot of new faces. And President Trump is back, and the golden age of America has most definitely begun. Does anyone have any questions for Patty or for me? No?
I have a question.
No. Anybody?
Okay. For a peaceful protest on Saturday for the military parade, President Trump would allow that.
Of course the president supports peaceful protests. What a stupid question. Raquel. Why was Renee Good unfortunately and tragically killed?
Are you asking me my opinion? Because an ICE agent acted recklessly and killed it unjustifiably.
Oh, okay. So you're a biased reporter with
you're
a left-wing opinion.
What do you want me to do?
Yeah, because you're a left-wing hack. You're not a reporter. You're posing in this room as a journalist.
Oh,
boy. Oh.
I'm almost speechless.
Almost. That's Caroline Leavitt. So the question is, when you have a press secretary who is instantly hostile, who is intent on distorting, in fact, doesn't that in effect create the environment in which leaks are going to happen, because reporters have to go around the press secretary knowing that they're not going to get factual information from that person?
Since this announcement, I've seen a couple of reporters who have actually said that she did a fairly good job behind the scenes of getting them information that they needed for real stories rather than the theater of the White House briefings. To give her that credit, there have been legitimate reporters who say, and they weren't Fox News reporters or semi-journalists, these were real reporters, said, she got me what I needed behind the scenes when I needed it.
Would take the crap that she's piling on them in person. It's one thing to be adversarial, and certainly she is by far not the first press secretary to be not telling the truth to the press corps, but her hostility is... the hostility factor is off the charts.
And she would intentionally distort. When, for example, Trump repeatedly said Iceland when he really meant Greenland, a reporter asked about it, and Leavitt said, no, he didn't. You're the only one mixing it up. In fact, he had said Iceland. Leavitt asks reporters and the public to deny what they actually can see and hear. And it is always a problem. Having been a political journalist for many years, I can say that we rely upon press aides to help us with the factual data that isn't open to interpretation. You assume that there is going to be some bias on the press secretary's part on behalf of the politician. But if you can't even trust them to give you facts as facts, then the credibility issue makes everything that they're doing.
And I'm usually very critical of the media because I don't think they ask hard enough questions. I don't think they ask follow-ups. They don't stay on top of a topic until they get, you're not going to get the an answer, but to get some kind of an answer, so that there's a weakness in on the media's part. But when you think of it from this perspective of what they're up against trying to just ask a question, you understand a little bit more.
And typically, a press secretary, even though they may not tell the whole truth, they will at least not directly lie.
As you.
Or they will, and traditionally they have tried not to answer the question, just like politicians. They don't want to get caught in a lie. She did not care about getting caught in a
lie. Sure, she could say, I'd get back to you, or I can't discuss this right now. Or
make some stab at credibility.
Remember Donald Trump's first press secretary, Sean Spicer, poor fellow, had to go out on the day that he was inaugurated and assert that it was true that there were more people at that inauguration than any other inauguration in history, which it was visually untrue.
Going to believe your eyes?
Yeah, absolutely.
See, that's when you want to leave to spend more time with your family.
I don't know. I think she's going to go on Dancing with the Stars.
No doubt. I've been a press secretary. I spent 4 years in Capitol Hill working as a press secretary for a member of Congress. And I know that it is difficult when you feel as though reporters are missing the story, or when they're sometimes there is incompetence, believe it or not, on the part of some journalists. And when you feel as though they're really...
Oh, shut your mouth.
But you can't...
You mean it's not the golden age
of... It is not golden age, by golly. And you want to defend your boss against what sound like unfair allegations, but you cannot lie, or your worth is absolutely shot. And, of course, that, as I was saying, leads reporters to then seek out other sources, who then get subpoenaed in an effort to uncover who the leaks are.
And just like the journalists we are now, Caroline Leavitt, she's gone. She's history. Who's going to replace her? I think one of the names mentioned so far has been Scott Jennings of CNN, who's been a pretty effective mouthpiece for the Trump administration as a CNN analyst. That's the only one I've heard so far. But what comes next could become even more of a problem for working journalists than Caroline Leavitt.
He doesn't seem nasty enough to satisfy Trump.
Sometimes being rational and being smart is even harder for a reporter to deal with.
Share your thoughts, folks. Media at WAMC.org. We're always happy to hear from you. I'm Rex Smith here with Barbara Lombardo and Judy Patrick in the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. By the way, speaking of our listeners, we need to make a correction thanks to Bill in Clintondale, New York. Yes, he said that either Rex or David said that you can't, speaking of David Gustina, our producer, you can't escape the use of AI in Google searches and how much you have to take, therefore, care in evaluating the results. In fact, Bill points out, in Google allows you to perform a non-AI search without the frequently hallucinogenic section at the top. Add the tag space AI at the end of your search with a space before it, and it will actually remove the AI aspect of your search.
Huh. It's a little cumbersome, but it's a very good tip.
A very good tip.
Space AI, space?
Space AI.
Is that a long space dash. Or a dash? Well, I'm going to try it, though. Good idea.
I don't know. Thank you, Bill.
Back to Bill if we can't make it work. Save that letter.
Speaking of another, and here's a letter you're really going to like. Jill writes in and says, I always enjoy the show, but this week was a lot of fun. Speaking of last week with David and Barb, that would be Barbara Lombardo and her son, David Lombardo, Capitol correspondent for WCNY Radio. Was here, so we had Mom and Chip off the old mom, right?
Nice person. No. We don't know. It's right. Not my mom.
It was not your mom, not named
Jill.
That
was very nice. Glad you enjoyed that.
That was fun. David's always good to have around here. He's a wonderful reporter. So on to other material. Before we leave the Trump aspect, and we'll get back to local stuff in just a moment, but here's a question that I think is worth doing. Donald Trump in the Oval Office was talking about, as he was signing the new executive order on vaccines, he said about the MMR combination shot, together there could be a possibility that they're quite lethal. Speaking of the measles, mumps, and rubella inoculation, the CDC's own website says that the MMR vaccine is very safe. Furthermore, Trump said, I've seen proof that they have a vaccination that looks like the size of a bottle of soda poured into a little baby's bottle. Now, here we have the president in effect, hallucinating, speaking of that word, on live TV. And the question is, how does a journalist go about contending with that? If you're covering that, or if you're then following up, how do you deal with absolute falsehood on the part of the president?
In the press conference about it, one reporter, I don't recall, he was
BC, I think.
Yeah, Steve Fortenberry,
like, maybe. Raised that, asking for the proof, and it was just a feeling, or he heard it, or whatever. But then it was dropped. That was the answer, asked and answered. And that, to me, was huge news, and still should be huge news. And every reporter should have been asking, where is the proof? When are you going to provide the proof? And more questions that are better than the way I'm phrasing it now, to just demand that the government is providing the documentation to show what he's claiming, because it has huge ramifications on the safety of Americans.
Trump has a common fallback line that some people say that.
Yeah.
He says that a lot as a justification for some of the crazy proposals he signed into law. But there were follow-up stories. Again, you're not getting the impact you get of covering the live press conference or the live Oval Office signing. But there were legitimately good follow-ups that demonstrated that there's not a Coke bottle full of medicine that gets vaccine that gets poured into a child's body. Even if you pour all of the vaccines they get in the first 10 years of their life, it's a drop in the body.
And the media did do a good job, and I looked for responses to that in headlines, in subheads, in the bodies of the stories. But it's going to keep getting repeated, and it gains veracity just by the repetition of it, and that we in the media need to, every time that's mentioned, say that this is not true. This is crazy.
Erin Burnett of CNN actually did what you need to do. She made it into a clippable moment, something that could be used on social media by actually bringing out a soda bottle and a syringe and showing it in front of the camera so that you could see the president's allegation that vaccination that looked like the size of a bottle of soda poured into a child's body.
And reusing that audio of him saying, where's the evidence?
Yeah, very hard.
There are charts out there today that show the rapid rise in measles. There have been more measles cases this year than in the last 25 years combined. This shocking rise in measles and the crazy justifications he's giving for not providing these vaccines. And the reporters are doing a good job of saying, when this happens, then maybe there won't be Medicaid funding. Or maybe if you're splitting the shots into three, a lot of children aren't going to make it back to the pediatricians for that second or third shot. There are conveniences the people have when it comes to immunization that are going to be, they're going to disappear. The other thing that really annoyed me was he was talking about the fact that when he took his kids to get their vaccines when they were little, do you believe that?
He doesn't even know their names.
Come on.
Okay. But it raises a question about ethical journalism, and here is actually an opportunity for us to talk about something else that is going on. The Code of Ethics of the Society of Professional Journalists is being revised. It's in the process of a big revision going on with the committee. It now is being submitted to the membership of the Society of Professional Journalists. Just to be clear to listeners, there is no requirement for journalists, of course, to follow any particular standards. The Code of Ethics is rather lengthy, but it has four fundamental elements that are not changing. Those are, first, seek the truth and report it. Second, minimize harm. Third, act independently. Fourth, be accountable and transparent. When I was the editor of the Times Union, I actually had those painted on the walls of our major conference room in the newsroom so that we could have it looking down on us all the time. But those four fundamentals are still core. And the question is, what difference does it make? Why is there even a bother with the Code of Ethics if there is no enforcement mechanism, right?
There's an enforcement. It's not a legal enforcement. It's your conscience. It's your moral duty. It's an imperative. And it's a great way of spelling it out, those four elements, the key things that every journalist needs to be thinking about when they're reporting.
So when I was reading through all the documents about this revision, first of all, I was glad I wasn't there because they were debating every semicolon and comma. But the other thing was, as you read it, it makes you give a real strong appreciation for what we do and how hard journalists try to be fair and accurate and report the truth. But the people who really need to see it are the people who don't trust us. And They are not going to take one look at this code of ethics, which is a shame because they are the people that I wish we could broadcast this to. The kinds of issues that are in our hearts, that are a foundation to what we do, they aren't being translated or they aren't being transferred to the general public as they should.
Through shows like this one, to emphasize how, as journalists and editors, that we are thinking about these kinds of things and we don't take it lightly. And some of these codes, the foundational codes, are in conflict with one another. So it's seeking the truth and report it and minimizing harm. And then how do you weigh which is important and who does it affect? And so that you're thinking about what you're doing.
I hope people understand that is actually at the heart of what good journalism is doing, that juxtaposition of values. We really have to think about that. That's why a machine can't actually do the reporting, I don't think, because it lacks the capacity for thoughtful judgment, for the moral code that underlies how far do you go minimizing harm. We recognize that truth-telling will sometimes hurt people. And so your goal is not to do no harm, as the code for physicians would have it, but it is to minimize harm consistent with the truth-telling responsibility. And you often find yourself making decisions in a newsroom where you're dealing with exactly that. The difficulty that I think we're confronting these days with the rise of a far greater role for independent journalists as legacy media have collapsed, with the rise of artificial intelligence, with the rapid spread of misinformation and disinformation, which just run rampant at extraordinary speed, while you have politicians intentionally trying to destroy public trust in the media, this places special responsibilities on journalists to really pay attention to these codes of ethics and to try to figure out what you can do to build credibility, to try to sustain the power of journalism going forward.
And the transparency issue, was it the top editor at Forbes who got canned for taking a $6 million gift? He definitely has a different circle of friends than I do.
$6 million bucks? I don't know.
Was that falling under the transparency? Once that came to light, he didn't last.
I don't know.
Act independently?
It was somebody who had a business relationship with Forbes, and the director, the editorial director, was forced to quit when this came out. And I have to say, if I were offered $6 million, I might question the code.
As I was reading through the code of this new, or this proposed code of ethics, it's the 100th anniversary of the code of ethics, by the way. One of the things I thought was lacking is more specifics helping working journalists deal with blatant lying, perhaps. They steer clear of the issue of who's a journalist and who's not. I understand why they didn't do it. Sometimes the vagueness is more of an impediment than a help. I understand that they didn't want to come right out and say AI. They wanted it to be more general. But again, the big issue we're facing right now, and maybe it's going to last 2 more years or 2.5 more years, is this blatant lying. How do you deal with that? And they're giving them some tools, but are they giving them enough tools?
Seeking the truth and reporting it fully is pretty cut and dried.
The new code of ethics as drafted is the authors are saying that what they're going to try to do is place greater emphasis on the character and responsibilities of ethical journalists, integrity, curiosity, conscientiousness, humanity, humility, and to give a little bit more guidance on verifying the origin and authenticity of information, which is really important in this era of AI.
That's a good one. People can see this on SPJ.org, Society Professional Journalists website, and actually take a look at it.
Very good. Finally, today, Worcester, Massachusetts is in the midst of an argument between the head of the police union and the publisher of an independent digital newsletter called This Week in Worcester. The union head wants $10 million in a libel suit over a story that was published in 2025. A story reported that the president of the union had threatened to remove union support from the police chief if charges weren't issued by the police against a city council member following an ICE operation in Worcester that had been very controversial. So all of this is around the difficulty here is that Massachusetts does not have a shield law under state law that protects the confidentiality of journalist sources. And the head of the publisher of This Week in Worcester is saying, I can't reveal my sources for this, but my reporting was accurate.
Then they you have to be able to go beyond the he said and she said. One guy says it's a lie, and the other person is saying, no, we have our sources correct. And the courtroom is the place where you need to determine which one is right.
What caught our attention in this case is the fact that we're worried that more and more small local newsrooms are going to be hit with these kinds of cases. That at the national level, when the Trump administration hits the BBC, the CBS, ABC, all the major news networks with libel lawsuits, that this is filtering down, and that the likelihood that small local operations are going to have to deal with these kinds of challenges, and they do not have the financial resources to do it. So that's the financial part of it. And the other part of it is it really does discourage people from being sources for important stories that the public has a right to know. In this case, if this story is true, that has to be established, definitely a public concern.
We are out of time. That's Judy Patrick, Barbara Lombardo, and I'm Rex Smith. With gratitude to our producer, Dave Gustina, and thanks to you for joining us once again this week for The Media Project.
Meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people, like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ding-a-ling, ding-a-ling, ling-a-ling-a-ling. Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for...
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, former editor of the Daily Gazette and former vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association, and Raga Justin, Albany bureau chief for Bloomberg Government. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the world. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.